Good morning. My name is Ben Jacobs, and on behalf of the Brookings Institution and the Board of Trustees, I welcome you all here this morning. My specific assignment today is to herald the release of the Brookings Metropolitan Policy Program's new report, Missed Opportunity, Transit and Jobs in Metropolitan America. This first-of-its-kind work represents that subject's most extensive analysis, mapping the transit routes, schedules, demographic data, employment opportunities, and information from the nation's 100 top metropolitan regions. From my presumably practical perspective as a developer of commercial, retail, hospitality, and residential properties, I have, over the past 48 years, come to appreciate the importance of location. Now, location, of course, is code for locations or places having characteristics which facilitate connecting people to quality employment opportunities by way of course, public transit. This is especially important in today's world, given fuel prices, public resources declining, continued sprawl, and uneven transit availability throughout metropolitan areas. Since learning of Metro Program's launch of this ambitious project, I've looked forward to attending today's discussion on this important research and its policy impact. Metro's report will have major implications for transit officials at all levels of government, regional employers, private sector investors, housing and social advocates across the country. Changing the fundamental dialogue about the connections between jobs and transit accessibility. Before I introduce Metro Program's Director and Brookings Vice President, Bruce Katz, allow me a moment on the Metro Program. Metropolitan Policy Program, one of five research programs at Brookings, was established almost 15 years ago. During this time, Bruce Katz and his dedicated colleagues have accomplished that which many in Washington spend their lifetimes aspiring, but never succeed. They have created and defined their own policy field, metro policy, and in so doing, have changed the way people look at this country, its inherent assets, and its ability to compete around the world. In order for our country to maintain its economic preeminence and continue a tradition of cultivating innovation, metro policy must transition from being new to being the norm. With the country at an inflection point, that embrace will define success for decades to come. The work of Brookings Metro Program has become the essential reference for creating a critical roadmap to build a more productive, sustainable, an inclusive next economy for metropolitan America. Bruce Katz will give us some political context for today's discussions, but before I yield, just a few words of introduction. Bruce is director of the Metro Program and is the longest-serving vice president at Brookings. He founded the Metro Program in 1996 after having served as chief of staff for HUD Secretary Henry Cisneros. Bruce is one of the nation's foremost thinkers on all matters metropolitan and has positioned Brookings to be the game changer in the field of urban studies, expanding the traditional scope from housing, community economic development, and planning-oriented area studies to one that is expansively yet pragmatically focused on building productive and sustainable metropolitan economies that are anchored in cities, surrounded by healthy suburbs, and supported by very strong state and federal partners. And with that, Bruce, I yield.
So thanks, Ben, for that introduction and for the advice and guidance you've given to us on this report and other research we have undergoing at Metro. Thanks to everyone here today. Thanks to folks who are on the live webcast. For those who are following us online, you can join in the conversation on Twitter, which is my newest obsession. and submit questions on the panel. I'll be moderating later with Secretaries Donovan and LaHood. And when you go to the webcast, it'll give you a sort of the link to how you actually do that. Before giving some context, I want to thank my colleagues who worked on this report. So Rob Puentes, Alan Berube, Adit Tomer, Elizabeth Kneebone, this is exhaustive work, complex project, 2 years, research that covers 100 metros, 371 transit providers, nearly 500 gigabytes of data. Literally billions of transit trips have been assessed. Other than census analysis that we've done here at Brookings, this is the largest database collected in the history of Brookings. In other words, this was an act of academic masochism. And you know, if they knew what they were getting into when they started, they wouldn't have done it. So I'd also like to thank the Ford Foundation, the Rockefeller Foundation, the Cerdna Foundation for their support of this work, and Microsoft, who has assisted us in the development of an interactive web tool that will debut today. So those of you who have followed the work of Metro over the past several years know that we believe the United States must embrace a different growth model post-recession and move towards what we call the next economy, one that is driven by exports and powered by low carbon and fueled by innovation and rich with opportunity. And that vision is intended to grapple with three macro and metro challenges, the need to create more jobs, the need to create better jobs, and the need to create accessible jobs. Why more jobs? Well, that's easy. The U.S. lost almost 9 million jobs during the Great Recession. We've only regained about 20% of the jobs lost to date. The national unemployment rate remains around 9%. The U.S. job machine is picking up 244,000 jobs in April. But if that pace of job growth continues, it would take about 29 months to regain all the jobs that were lost during the recession. And we all know that's not sufficient because our population continues to grow. Why better jobs? This was a brutal decade for low and moderate and middle income workers. The economic boom of the 2000s was the first on record in the U.S. where median family income actually declined by about $2,000 per household. The recession obviously made matters much, much worse. 93% of households experienced either a decline in their wealth or earnings or a major increase in spending. 23% of households reported a drop of at least a quarter of their annual household incomes. So we now need to build an economy that works for working families. That's why we focus on productive and export-oriented industries, since firms in those sectors pay workers more and are more likely to provide health and retirement benefits. So that takes us to the final challenge, accessible jobs. It's not enough to create more and better jobs if workers can't get to them. Over the past several decades, employment has become increasingly decentralized in what can only be described as an exit ramp economy in the United States. As of 2006, 45% of jobs in the top metropolitan areas were over 10 miles away from the central business district. Only about a fifth of jobs are within 3 miles of the central business district. So these location dynamics have completely upended the daily commute in the United States. Commuting in the U.S. from home to work has become an heroic act, as more people are commuting further and further to their jobs. With gas prices now averaging just under $4 a gallon, this is becoming a burden many families cannot afford. The ramifications of higher fuel prices are extensive. They're damaging to an already fragile economic recovery. Those that will be especially hurt by this are low and moderate income families. The projected increase in gas prices suggests that fuel costs for the average household will be about $825 higher in 2011 than they were in 2010. So that's too high a price. And if history is any guide, many families will now see public transit, if it is available, as a viable option, especially for people commuting from the suburbs. So here are the questions of the day. As families explore transportation alternatives, how efficient and reliable are transit systems in the top 100 metropolitan areas? Is transit ready for what could be a transit moment? Are metros capable of growing in ways that support reliable and tolerable commutes? And what can the private sector do? Now, this is a scholarly report. It is clearly not an academic exercise. For federal and macro policymakers focused on the jobs deficit, the message is clear. Again, it's not enough to create jobs if people can't get to them. For states consumed with budget deficits, this is not the time to sever the lifelines for low-income commuters. Transit is being cut in many states around the country. For cities and metros characterized by sprawling jobs and concentrated poverty, it is time to grow smart and align transport, housing, land, and economic policy. And for the private sector, there is an enormous role for you to fill here. Ride sharing, car sharing, private transit, intelligent transport systems. So that's what we're here to discuss this morning. To begin, Rob Puentes, Senior Fellow, Director of the Metropolitan Infrastructure Initiative at Brookings, and a co-author of the report, will present on the major findings. We'll then have two excellent panels that will approach the issues of transit and job accessibility at all levels, first state and metro, then federal. The first panel will be moderated by Robert Thompson, Dr. Gridlock from the Washington Post, and will include co-author and senior fellow Alan Berube. Then I'll moderate a panel with the Secretary of Housing and Urban Development, Sean Donovan, and the Secretary of Transportation, Ray LaHood. During this panel, as I noted at the beginning, we'll be accepting questions via Twitter for those watching online. And frankly, for everyone here today, as you walk away from this event, I don't know how many of you tweet, maybe you blog, maybe you do videos. We've seen what happened in the Middle East with Twitter and Facebook and a whole bunch of other social media. We have to stop having forums in Washington, D.C. with just 200 people in the room. So this is an experiment for us to see if we can reach outside the traditional beltway conversation and include, particularly for an issue that affects tens of millions of Americans, so many of the people who are not in this room. Rob Puentes, stage is yours.
Thanks, Bruce. Thanks very much. Those were great, great introductory comments. Never heard the word tweet so much in this room before. And thank you all for being here today at Brookings, you know, to the folks in the room, and thank you to all those who are watching online. I do want to point out that, as Bruce mentioned, although this is definitely something that we have been working on at Brookings for a number of years, it's not just something we cooked up here, you know, on Massachusetts Avenue. This is something that we have been working intensely with a whole network of scholars and practitioners all across the country, many folks actually who are in the room today, because this is not something that we could just identify here in Washington. This is not just a made-in-Washington type approach, but really does reflect, I think, a lot of the unique traditions, the history, and the reality of what's going on in metropolitan areas all across the country. But I do want to thank, just very quickly, thank the authors again, Adi, Elizabeth, Alan, who you'll be hearing from in a minute. Bruce talked about the incredible amount of effort that went into this project. This is really a testament to their hard work and really their dedication to Brookings' commitment to quality, impactful, and independent work. So they had the hard part, right? So in many ways, I have the easy part being up here today making this presentation. And the fun part, really, because it's good to be talking about transit in metropolitan areas here at Brookings this afternoon. We found, as we were doing this work, that people are passionate about this issue. I think we were surprised, frankly, about how passionate people really care about this in their area, not just because of the reasons that we're going to talk about today, but they really understand, I think, what transit means for a functioning, healthy city and healthy suburbs and healthy metropolitan areas. And that's a good thing, because we believe that we may have a public transit moment before us in the United States today. For major metropolitan systems with iconic transit, like we have in New York and in Washington, to new light rail lines that have just opened up in places like Phoenix, places like Charlotte, to growing bus networks in places like Colorado Springs or in Albuquerque, New Mexico, Even the ferry boats that traverse the Puget Sound and the Boston Harbor, public transit is a critical part of the economic and social fabric of these, as well as metropolitan areas all across the U.S. Every year, 10 billion trips are taken using public transit, a number that we have seen has generally been trending up in recent years. Almost all of these trips occur in the nation's 100 largest metros. As Bruce mentioned, and if you've been following our work, these places are the real heart of the American economy and harbor two-thirds of our population, generate 75% of our gross domestic product, and account for 95% of all transit passenger miles traveled. So we look at the top 100 metros, but this is where almost all of this transit is occurring. And every single one of the top 100 metros has some form of public transit. Education, shopping, recreation, healthcare, these are some of the reasons why people take transit in America today. But one of the most important, and the reason we're here to talk about today, is to get to work. While three of four commutes still occur alone in a car, recent statistics show that the share of Americans getting to work by transit grew during the last decade for a first time literally in a generation. Despite the recent leveling off due to the recession, we do consider this to be a moment for public transit in America, and there are several driving forces behind that. First is the emerging disruption of escalating gas prices we already talked about. The U.S. Energy Information Administration, along with most Americans, folks here in the room, are already looking out for $4 gas if we're not seeing it already, which I know we are. These rising fuel prices will drive increased demand for transit as commuters seek to reduce their overall traffic costs. But whether commuters will shift to transit is not just a result of this or a result of the prices, but it's really the result of many things, including whether or not transit is even available and whether it gets them to where they want to go. So more on that in just a minute. Transit will also benefit from the fact that we continue to be a growing nation. By 2050, we could grow incredibly by another 130 million people. That's more than the entire population that today lives west of the Mississippi River. What is more is that three-quarters of this growth will occur in metropolitan areas. Another driving force is the imperative of lower carbon. Today in the U.S., transportation is the single largest contributor to our nation's carbon footprint. And even small increases in driving will still spew out more and more carbon, potentially wiping out the benefits that are gained from more fuel-efficient cars and the expansion of cleaner fuel alternatives. So given all this, the natural question that we want to talk about today is, are we ready for this public transit moment? How well does transit cover our metropolitan areas? How well does transit connect workers to jobs? And how well does transit function for those workers who may need it the most? Are we ready? Our challenge is that, and when we tried to answer these questions, we found that strikingly little was known about this across the country. In the U.S. today, we have no consistent transit information across and between metropolitan areas. So to better understand these issues, we analyzed, collected, and in some cases, we actually had to build geospatial data for 371 systems that provide transit service in the nation's 100 largest metro areas. As you can imagine, that data collection was the hard part. In some cases, the data were easy to find, such as the information that goes into web-based transit routing tools, which many of the nation's transit systems use, many folks here in the room probably use. In other cases, like when we got this information on paper, we had to create digital route and schedule information from scratch. All this was very time-consuming. But the transit database and the comprehensive database that resulted provides the first comparable detailed look at the relationship between transit, service, income, and the location of employment. So let's see how all this plays out in Denver, a metro area with a robust network of transit routes. As you can see, this really mirrors the street grid in that metro area. So a worker living in Littleton, a southern suburb, could walk to the new light rail line a few blocks from their home and ride it all the way to work near 16th and California, near the corner of downtown Denver. There are no transfers required, and this whole trip would take you about 34 minutes from door to door. To get to a job in the eastern suburb of Stapleton, that commuter would continue on the train, then transfer it to a bus, and that whole trip would take about 85 minutes. So our model simulated billions and billions of similar commute trips for every neighborhood with transit service in the top 100 metro areas. That may not mean a lot to the people in the room. It meant an awful lot to us. So what do we find? First is that nationally, we face a transit paradox between transit coverage and job access. Second is that by virtue of policy or the market and really a little luck, quite frankly, there's clear variation between metropolitan areas. And third, we definitely need a new game plan for helping Americans get to work. So to start, let me return to that paradox, which is that while some form of transit serves a large share of metropolitan America, that same service really does fall short in connecting residents to employment, especially when those jobs are outside of the urban core. So let's dig into that first part a little. Where and whom does transit serve today in metropolitan America? For transit coverage, we're talking here about the share of working-age residents living in neighborhoods within at least 3/4 of a mile of a transit stop. Based on that definition, we found that across the nation's 100 largest metros, nearly 70% of working-age people live in residents with live in neighborhoods with transit coverage. Or, to put it another way, while almost 40 million Americans are without transit service in their communities, another 88 million Americans do have transit coverage. Now, we recognize that service and convenience are not the same thing, and all transit stops are not created equal. But overall, I think it's we can understand that we found these numbers really good, and we found them really quite encouraging. And while 70% of working-age people have transit coverage, we found that the numbers are even better for poor neighborhoods, as 89% of metropolitan residents in lower-income communities are served. This greatly exceeds the shares for middle- and high-income neighborhoods, which you can see are at about 70 and 53%, respectively. Not surprisingly, given the well-known historical connections between cities and transit agencies, we found that an amazing 94% of city residents live in neighborhoods with transit coverage. Now, I know these are an awful lot of numbers, in a very abstract way. So let me drill in just for a moment on Central Virginia and see how all this plays out in one place, in metropolitan Richmond, which is outlined there in gray with the city of Richmond in the middle. The darker colored neighborhoods you're seeing here are those with higher population densities. And as we zoom into one neighborhood close to the downtown part of the city, you can clearly see the bus lines that are out there in white and the hub and spoke nature of the transit network. Dense neighborhoods in central cities generally have strong transit coverage like this, as we're seeing here in downtown Richmond. But that's just a city example. So what about the 2/3 of Americans, then, who live in suburbs? What do we think transit coverage looks like for them? Well, we found that only 58% of suburban residents live in neighborhoods that are served by transit. So let's go back and look out into the Richmond suburbs, such as this relatively dense neighborhood west of the city that is literally at the end of the line for bus service. As you can see, its neighboring suburban communities generally lack transit service coverage altogether, and we found that this is typical in many metros across the U.S., and I'll get to that in just a minute. Now, while these city-suburban trends have emerged over the decades for an awful lot of reasons, they are in some ways a bit anachronistic now that we know a majority of jobs and a majority of low-income households are in the suburbs. So the future efficacy of metropolitan transit systems will thus rest squarely on their ability to reach the growing segment of suburban and particularly low-income suburban commuters. This leads directly into the other part of the transit paradox, which is that in most metro areas, transit does fall short in connecting workers to jobs, as I mentioned. In other words, and as Bruce mentioned, it's not enough for us just to know that transit exists in these neighborhoods. Transit doesn't do you any good if it doesn't get you to where you want to go within a reasonable period of time. So job access is the other critical part of the analysis. For this, we're talking about the share of metropolitan jobs that a typical working-age resident can reach by transit within 90 minutes. Based on this definition, we found that 30% of jobs are accessible. Or put differently, 70% of jobs in the nation's largest metro areas are inaccessible to the average commuter. Here, too, there are important splits between cities and suburbs to keep in mind. For one, the job access figures are much better for city neighborhoods than suburban ones. But again, obviously the point is not that a worker can reach all jobs throughout their metro area. What really matters is what kind of jobs you can get to, and then are you qualified for those jobs that are out there? And we found that workers in neighborhoods with transit can reach over, or can reach just over 1/4 of job, of, I'm sorry, we can reach just over 1/4 of low and medium skilled jobs within 90 minutes, compared to 1/3 of metro area jobs in high skill industries. So clearly what emerges then is this mismatch. High income households are in neighborhoods with the worst transit coverage, yet high skilled jobs are the most accessible by transit. On the flip side, low income households are in neighborhoods with the best transit coverage, but they are in many ways less able to use transit to get to these jobs that they likely qualified for. It's not exactly neat, but you can see where the mismatch occurs. And taken together, these findings suggest that in many places, there is a disconnect between where people live and where people work. However, these aggregate numbers also hide a great amount of variation. We are a big, big country. For example, we found a lot of difference in transit coverage rates between these metropolitan areas. So let's take Los Angeles, for example, where 96% of metropolitan residents live in neighborhoods with transit service of some kind. As you can see here, nearly every one of these neighborhoods has some kind of transit coverage. Other major metros like New York or Miami, here in Washington, D.C., all these places have transit coverage that far exceeds the national average. Contrast this with metros in the South, like Atlanta, where less than 40% of residents have transit coverage. This map shows a concentration of service in the city, but as you can see, very limited service outside of that urban core. Other southern metros like Birmingham and Nashville, Greenville, South Carolina, all lack service to over two-thirds of their metropolitan residents. There's also variation then in terms of the jobs that these metros, in these metros that are accessible by transit, so the second part of that paradox. In Salt Lake City, in San Jose, in Portland, Oregon, the typical commuter can get to a large share of these metro jobs by transit. But check out the figures then for places like Youngstown or Orlando or McAllen, Texas, much, much less. So to better account for the big picture, we brought together the transit coverage and the transit job access rankings and ratios into a combined transit performance metric to indicate then the best and worst metropolitan performers. 15 of the top 20 metro areas that rank the highest on this score are found in the West, and 15 of the 20 metros that score the lowest are found in the South. Well, why? Why do Western metros seem to perform the best? Well, for starters, it looks like these are places that have invested heavily in their transit systems, and we're not just talking about the new rail service or the light rail systems. The bus networks in many of these metros are extensive, and they reach well out into the suburbs, intentionally out into the suburbs. They're also much more likely than others to combine comprehensive planning with growth management policies that employ infrastructure regulations such as impact fees. Jobs and housing are more compact than in other metro areas, and it makes it all easier to serve by transit. They're also much more likely to have topographical barriers to development. This is the luck part. Mountains, deserts, oceans, things like that, all help hem in the outward trajectory of growth in many of these Western places. Okay, why then do Southern metros perform the worst? Well, obviously, it's a little bit of the reverse. These are generally not places with extensive transit coverage. And the transit service that does exist generally does not reach out into the suburbs. We saw that in Atlanta. They tend to not employ innovative land use tools and instead stick with a traditional regulatory framework where residential and commercial uses are kept separate and development is spread out. In such places, it's very difficult to connect people to jobs by transit in any kind of efficient manner. And to go along with that, these are places that have few topographical barriers to control the outward migration of growth. So the bottom line here is that the success of transit in helping commuters get to work rises and falls on much more than just the transit system itself. Transportation networks interact with the location of employment and housing in really very complex ways that influence a lot of the metrics that we analyzed here in this report. So given all that, my final point is that we definitely need a new game plan for helping Americans get to work. As Bruce said in his introduction, in the post-recession economy, we need more jobs, and we need better jobs, and we also need to make sure that those jobs are accessible. But while there is definitely potential for a transit moment in the U.S. today, severe budget constraints and rapidly fluctuating energy prices and transportation costs complicate this route, then, to broader economic recovery. In the short run, transit agencies face real threats in the form of service cuts, delayed investments, as well as deferred maintenance. Revenue declines are widespread, and many agencies are already facing increases in terms of fares to go along with operating cuts in order to close these yawning budget gaps in many metro areas. At the same time, transit agencies and commuters alike are struggling with the impacts of higher gasoline prices, as Bruce mentioned. As rising prices put greater pressure on household budgets, it's clear that more and more people are going to be looking for alternatives to the driving that they're doing today. In light of these challenges, we do need a three-part plan. The first thing is that we need a total transportation approach to job access. Some metros like Washington, like Los Angeles, like Hartford, Connecticut, will and should continue to build out their rail and bus rapid transit infrastructure to address the coverage gaps that we've identified here in this report. But metros also need a range of other transportation options, like car sharing, which is already underway in many metropolitan areas, and privately run services that connect to corporate campuses like they do out in metropolitan Seattle. But as we noted, our results show that it's not just enough to have robust transit or transportation service. So the second thing is to go beyond transportation and link accessibility to next-generation metropolitan growth policy and practice. What does that mean? To make the most out of existing service and plan for future routes and investments, metro leaders need to pursue integrated problem-solving across a range of disciplines. One way, we think, is to incorporate land use policies to improve job access, and that may do that better than just these transit interventions alone. This includes efforts we'll hear about in a minute to reduce decentralized growth like they're doing in Sacramento by examining existing land use patterns, density, urban form, to find innovative solutions to challenges like housing, like carbon emissions, like agricultural preservation, and like job access. But to reiterate, it's not just a matter of how many jobs that can be reached, but what kinds of jobs. So while coordinated transit planning and land use is a necessary step, our analysis does demonstrate that those efforts must explicitly address the apparent mismatch between household access and job skills. And for their part, the largely successful transit-oriented development efforts of the past decades should probably be placing a stronger emphasis on locating jobs in these areas to complicate their strong residential focus. Lastly, we've got to harness the power of information. Smart decision-making begins with comprehensive and accurate data. However, this research project revealed that many agencies lack the fundamental pieces to construct the measures that are necessary for this next-generation policymaking. So we recommend that the federal government work with its metropolitan transit partners to maintain an updated database of standardized transit data. This information will not only help local leaders create better strategies and get the maximum benefit out of their own transit systems, but by having a comparable, consistent set of information, we think the federal government can then use job access as a key metric as it starts to experiment and award some types of discretionary grants, building on all the good efforts so far. So to demonstrate the power of this kind of information, we partnered with Microsoft to make the detailed findings of this project available on an interactive mapping tool that's available on the Brookings website. Each of you will be able to leave here today, I see people on their iPads already that are already doing this, and personally investigate how transit performs in your metro area and in your neighborhood. We think this tool should serve as an example of what relatively small investments in data can do to dramatically improve infrastructure and other decision making. So let me then end with a quote from my favorite philosopher, Yogi Berra. Yogi said, "If you always do what you always did, you'll always get what you always got." And one thing I think this report makes clear is that we just can't keep doing what we always did. We can't keep ripping the wires out of our metropolitan transit networks, nor can we just indiscriminately invest without purpose. This is definitely a time to invest in America, but we've got to invest smarter. By filling in the transit service gaps in our metropolitan networks, by going beyond transit and linking those investments up with how metropolitan areas grow and develop, and by deploying advanced technology and information systems to enable us to make better decisions. U.S. metropolitan areas, we think, have an awful lot to show for a century's worth of transit investment. But more needs to be done to ensure that transit connects workers to jobs here in the 21st century metropolis. And we think that now is the time to start doing that. I want to thank you very much for coming here today, and I'm very much looking forward to the discussion that follows. And, in fact, I think we have time for some questions or comments from the audience. There's a mic coming around.
Hi, I'm Brian O'Malley from Baltimore, Maryland. I wanted to ask about the three-quarter mile, the use of the three-quarter mile as the barrier for transit access, because usually people talk about a half mile or sometimes even a quarter mile. And then the second part of that question is a three-quarter mile the same, is obviously not the same in Manhattan or metro or downtown D.C. as it is in a suburb. And were you able to account for that?
every other question about the three-quarter mile radius around these stations. So I'm glad we're jumping into the really easy questions, right? And make no mistake, this was something that we, as we worked through this project, and we worked with this advisory board of scholars and practitioners all across the country, we went all around on this and some other issues. And we found that some of those early metrics that we use, the quarter mile radius or the half mile radius, all these things make sense in different areas, but we had a hard time tracking down why we're using those. I think they may intuitively make sense to some people, but we really had a hard time figuring out empirically why that was exactly the best one. The studies are kind of all over the place on this. So we chose 3/4 mile in order to make it a little bit more expansive to give people the benefit of the doubt. You're right, it looks very different in Manhattan than it does in Manhattan, Kansas, or Kansas City, or a different place. It looks very different if you're walking up a hill, right, to get to work, as if you're walking, in an attractive neighborhood. So, again, the idea for 3/4 mile was to be as expansive as possible, to give folks the benefit of the doubt, and to be as inclusive as possible. Tony Downs.
Rob, I think you've given a very interesting report, but essentially you're saying we need metropolitan government to operate, to carry out all the policies that you think are sensible in order to have a single plan for the entire metro area. How do we get that?
Another easy question. Clearly, I think when we looked at these rankings and we saw these splits between the western metros and the southern metros and the northeast metros, we started to think about what is going on in these western places that was different from the others. And you do see a different type of metropolitan decision-making that's going on. It's not necessarily metropolitan governance, right, but it's a different kind of metropolitan scope for how places like Denver thinks about all the growth that's projected for that region over the next bunch of years and then how they coordinate that with the transit investments that they were making. So it's happening on a metropolitan scale, right, but it's not happening because of one metropolitan government necessarily, but it's the kind of the buy-in of the entire metro area. The folks from Sacramento will probably talk about this during the panel discussion later. These are part of larger metropolitan decision-making, right? It's happening on a large scale, but it's not the government necessarily like we have in a place like Portland. And then the flip side, when we started to look at places like in the Midwest in particular, we saw tremendous fragmentation in terms of transit agencies. And this is, as Adika talked about, one of the real surprises in that a lot of places in the West may have one transit agency or two transit agencies, very few metropolitan transit systems. In the Northeast and the Midwest, it was dozens, quite frankly, where you add buses that stop at borders of jurisdictions and don't continue into another jurisdiction. That's the kind of stuff that we need to get beyond, as opposed to maybe a large metropolitan government, which you're right, is a very complex thing to do. Okay, one more question. Maybe not so close to the end, maybe in the middle.
Rob, Art Gazzetti with the American Public Transportation Association. Certainly the report includes a wealth of constructive thinking, and I commend you for that. I'd like to sort of talk about your overarching theme, which is societal trends, which in the early 1900s, the metro areas were developed around public transportation. The latter part of the 20th century, it became more developed around automobile patterns and based on cheap energy. Well, now, as you pointed out, the era of cheap energy, there's evidence that that's coming to an end. Transportation policies, of course, we're all working on that, but there's evidence that we're moving towards a more balanced system. So I'm thinking that, just in a big picture sense, it's just following those major societal trends. Transit-oriented, early 1900s, auto-oriented later, and now we're coming up to the next, say, generation of transportation policy that's aligned with those trends. Is that an assessment of sort of what the report is talking about, or no?
Thanks, Art. Yes, I think that's very well said. And in fact, when we started to look, again, back to these geographic splits, right, we saw in these western areas, though, these are some of the places that are growing now, right? This is where a lot of that 130 million new Americans are going to. It's not going to parts of the Northeast and the Midwest, right, for the most part. It's happening in the Intermountain West. And these are the places, back to Tony's comment, that are already looking ahead. And so they're planning for a very different type of metropolitan physical form and the spatial landscape of these places that doesn't just include an automobile orientation. I mean, clearly, we're not moving everybody from one mode to another. The modes really don't really matter. What we're talking about here is a balanced transportation system. And places in the West where all the fast growth is happening are the places I think that are starting to get to that balance we're talking about. It's a good question. All right, so my next job then is to introduce the next panel, which will be moderated today by Robert Thompson, who's a writer and a columnist for the Washington Post. Folks here in this room, and I suspect many folks watching on the webcast, probably know him better by his alias, Dr. Gridlock. The doctor is an authority on transportation projects around the region, and he weighs in every day with advice and information to make commutes more manageable for residents here in the D.C. region. If you commute in the D.C. region and you don't follow his Twitter feeds, you really should be doing that. Bob has been a reporter for an editor for 30 years in New York and Washington. He joined the Post in 1988, and in 1999, he became the Post transportation editor. So please join me in welcoming Bob and our other panelists to the stage.
Good morning. I am Washington's Dear Abbey of Traffic. I counsel travelers who are very angry when they can't get where they want to go and don't understand why. Often I don't understand why either, but I try to console them. Most of my readers, as people nationwide, drive to work, yet at least half of the letters that I get, the Dear Dr. Gridlock letters that I get, are complaints about transit. Our collective vision of the U.S. transportation system is usually represented by a photo of an eight-lane highway with cars and trucks grinding to a halt during rush hour. Issues in transit don't often achieve the same profile nationally. So it's a pleasure to be part of a discussion here today that highlights the importance of transit in determining how Americans will get around in the 21st century. I'll moderate a few rounds of questions among our panelists, then invite audience members into a Q&A with them. When we get to that, please follow the pattern we just used of getting the roving mic and identifying yourself and your organization before asking your question. We have three panelists from other regions whose transit needs are assessed in the study. In the public transit game, Keith Parker, to my left here, he's a player, not just a fan. He's in charge of the VIA transit system in San Antonio, Texas. Before that, he was in charge of transit in Charlotte, North Carolina. I'll be asking Keith to share his perspective as a transit manager on the findings of the study. To his left, Matt Mayhood is president and CEO of the Chamber of Commerce in Sacramento, California. The Chamber has many transportation improvements on its list of needs, and Matt has been in Washington this week to advance those causes. I'll be asking Matt to share the business perspective on transit and jobs issues. At the far end is Poncella Hardaway. She's executive director of Metropolitan Organizing Strategy Enabling Strength, easier to remember as MOSES. Her community organization in Detroit has incorporated public transportation into its agenda for improving the quality of life in Southeast Michigan. I'll be asking Poncella to explain what more transit could do for a community and why it's so difficult to bring it in. Our fourth panelist, Alan Berube, helped create the study that drew us all here today. He's a senior fellow and research director at Brookings. His areas of expertise include urban and suburban poverty and demographics for metropolitan areas. Among other things, I'll be asking Alan to give us a national perspective on some issues surrounding transit and low-income communities. Now, I've shortchanged all of our panelists on their resumes, so I invite you to read more about them in the literature, and also I hope that you'll start to understand their wealth of experience in these areas as we go through some of the questions. So I'd like to start the first round of introductory questions with Keith. And even though he has background in many different areas of the country, I'd like him to focus on San Antonio for the moment and just give us a sense of the environment there, the transit environment there. Who Keith is trying to use transit to get where in the San Antonio region?
Well, thank you for the opportunity to address such a great-looking group. You know, when they first told me I'd have a chance to chat with the Brookings Institution, they said all these people in the audience would be nerds and geeks and policy wonks, and only about half of you are, so it's a looking group. Well, San Antonio is a pretty unique story in many respects. If you look at the economy of our region, it's actually one of the strongest in the entire country, and a lot of that's due to the fact that we have a huge military presence, and while many things have shrunk over the past few years, the military is not one of them. In addition, our housing has not declined in many of the ways that other places from around the country have. As it relates to public transit, our story is one that we want to build upon. We have a tremendous number of people who are completely dependent on the public transportation system on a daily basis. We carry about 145,000 people a day on a network of about 500 buses. And the typical person who rides our service is a Hispanic female who earns between $10,000 and $14,000 a year. So very, very low wealth population group. And what we're trying to do is build off of the people who need us and provide even better and higher quality service for those folks, or at the same time begin to attract the rider who have more options, people who own automobiles but who would choose to ride us. And we're beginning to make some major inroads in that. Part of what we've recognized is we have to segment our markets. So we are developing products that attract certain folks to the transit system that may not be universal throughout the transit system, if you understand me. So we're seeing dramatic increases in ridership amongst the choice riders, particularly on our express routes, where just last month we were up 24% from this time of April 2010. And we're beginning to see even more frequency of riders in some of the smaller segments like school-age population, elderly and disabled, and those types of groups. So we're seeing a real growth in the ridership, but know we need to do a lot more to attract an even greater audience to our products.
Matt, a similar introductory question for you. Please help us understand the transit environment in the Sacramento region. Tell us. Who's trying to use transit to get where?
Okay. Actually, I wanted to ask Keith, which half of the room? What are you kidding?
They know who they are.
Thank you for the opportunity to be here. Actually, in the Sacramento region, Sacramento is the state capital of California, the eighth largest economy in the world. And Sacramento, being the state capital, 28% of the employment in our region is either city, county, state, or federal employees. So quite honestly, it is, and most of those job centers for government employment are in the downtown core. So the majority of our ridership, at least from what I see and experience, I'm not a transit techie. I can't throw the statistics at you, and I won't do that today. I'm a business guy. It is those government employees trying to get from their suburban homes down into the downtown core, and some folks trying to make that opposite trip.
Thanks, Matt. Let me go down to Poncela just to complete these regional introductions. Poncela, please, in a similar vein, tell us about the Detroit area, the transit environment there, who's trying to take transit to get where.
Thank you for the opportunity to respond to this. I'm not a transit expert. We are a community organization, and about last summer, we actually had many of our leaders actually ride the buses throughout the region as an effort to educate the community about the possibility of obtaining mass transit. And what we found were certain routes that were very heavy going from downtown Detroit down Woodward. And then we had in Macomb County the Gratiot route going out to the suburbs and a huge shift going further out into northern Oakland County. So we're all over the place. So, you know, we have a lot of young students who are trying to get to community colleges, Oakland University, who need mass transit to get there. So we find a lot of them, a lot of workers working in Oakland County from Detroit going out, the older sector, single mom going out to obtain jobs that might be at living wage. And we have a lot of business people coming in from the suburbs into downtown Detroit. So we're everywhere in Metro Detroit.
Thank you, Poncella. Alan, now, please help us understand, we've heard from our three regional panelists, San Antonio isn't Sacramento, Sacramento isn't Detroit, but the study that you folks did shows us pretty consistently that we're failing to link transit to the jobs. How come we all turned out so similarly? How come in the study we don't see more outliers? How come somebody didn't get everything right?
Nobody ever does, do they? Just to return to Keith's point for a minute, I'd say one thing we did in order to reduce the geek quotient in the audience was to put one of us on the stage next to you. Bob, I mean, your point is right. I think, you know, on the two big axes we looked at in this report in terms of who transit serves and where it gets them to, there are distinctions between the metros we have on the stage here. San Antonio does good on both. Sacramento has good coverage, but not so great job access, and Detroit doesn't do great really on either. But in a way, the story is the same if you think about, you know, where the United States and its metropolitan areas are, you know, maybe compared to a lot of our competitors across the globe. Good coverage, limited access, cities much better served than suburbs are, even though two-thirds of our metropolitan population lives in suburbs. And these low and middle skill jobs, as Rob was talking about in his presentation in particular, less accessible via transit. So I think, you know, what's common across these places in terms of why this is the case is that really we've got these legacy systems that were built and designed in the middle of the 20th century that have just been, in a sense, trying to play catch-up to these metropolitan growth and development patterns where people and the jobs are kind of moving away from the transit and the transit is kind of running up a down escalator in order to try to catch up with it. We've missed opportunities to link up other public policies with transit in terms of, say, where we place affordable housing in our metropolitan areas, where we try to do commercial development in low-income communities. This hasn't always been connected to where transit is. And then, frankly, look, I mean, we've got a little bit of an existential crisis in metropolitan America in terms of what we think about transit. We have mixed attitudes about the role of transit in the economy and in public life, too. I do think, you know, given that, you know, somewhat bleak picture, though, for the reasons that Rob talked about, the questioner about what changes are going on in America today demographically and economically, I do think there's a sense that the tide could be turning in terms of where energy prices are headed, in terms of our continued population growth, in terms of what the new economy values in terms of density, the importance of the knowledge economy being clustered, businesses and workers being closer to one another in order to take advantage of innovation. And that's what I think we meant by the transit moment. So even if we're not really where we want to be, I think there's a potential there. And so we're really asking the question, who's ready? Some places are more ready than others, but I think it's fair to say everybody's got quite a ways to go.
Thanks, Alan. Let me come back to you, Keith, and see if we can zoom in on some of your experience, not only in San Antonio now, but previously in Charlotte and Richmond. As you think about the results of the study, help us understand in these regions why transit doesn't take more people to where they work.
I think we just need to shift how we think about public transit from simply being, let's look at some matrix, and if you score high on this matrix, then you're a good transit system. If you don't, you're not. And instead think about it as a public investment, similar to what you would expect in a high quality of life environment. Everyone believes that we need good public schools, good fire departments, good police departments, and we also need good transit systems. And so if we think of them that way, I think we will begin to show investment in those ways. Because when you think about the return on investment, that an investment in public transit, for every $1 billion you spend in public transit, 30,000 new jobs are created. If a family of four were to give up just one of their cars, they can save upwards of $10,000 a year if if a family of four gives up just one of their automobiles, has a greater impact on the environment than just about anything else you can do. And a study that just came out of Charlotte recently shows that the typical transit rider, if you hold all other demographics equal, loses on average 6.5 pounds per year. So you can improve the environment, save money, stimulate the economy, and lose a few pounds. What else can you do with that type of public investment? So I think if we start to shift the conversation to let's put some resources into public transit, and then all these great things will begin to follow. Now, more specifically to answer your question, I think what stratifies the results quite a bit is just the politics of these given areas. In the West, you typically have groups that believe that more collaborative solutions to societal problems are bigger, whereas in the South, you tend to have more of each person takes care of their own, that government, any government involvement is really viewed as government intrusion and that type of thing. So you see that, and then when you look at what happens with the results of this study, they fit almost perfectly aligned.
Thanks, Keith. And I'll go to Matt next and ask him to shed some more light on the Sacramento area and this, to me anyway, seemingly weird split between really good access to transit for whatever a person's income level is, but very few of those people can reach their jobs via transit. Why? Can you help us understand, Matt, why the region grew up in that way?
Yeah, it's I think Sacramento's story is much like many cities around the country, and that is that we simply, as we grew, and we grew rapidly as a region in the 90s and the early 2000s, just phenomenal growth, it was sprawl. And it was a lot easier for our major employers who moved to the Sacramento region, many of them who came from the Silicon Valley, because they could no longer find the office space that they needed to expand their office or their manufacturing facilities. Many of those major employers moved to the suburbs, and they moved into greenfield developments because in the state of California, it's a lot easier to develop in greenfields than and put a big warehouse or a big office space in a nice open area right off the interstate than it is to do brownfield, infill development, or encourage folks to come back into the core. At the same time, we had large developments occurring, housing developments occurring in the suburbs, farther and farther away from the core, and we did not have a coordinated plan to build our employment centers here and our suburban housing here. We put our office buildings here, and then, you know, farther up the hill or over here across the river, we put our housing centers. And there was no strategic plan at the time. However, we have learned over the course of the last several years, and we do an annual study mission, the Chamber does, and we partner with private and public sector to go study what other regions do. And we have been to San Antonio, we have been to Charlotte, but we also went to Atlanta in the early 2000s to see what their sprawl really did. And if there's anybody from Atlanta, I'm sorry, but we went to Atlanta and we came back and said, we don't want to grow like that. And it really, we had a moment in Sacramento, and we have a phenomenal COG, Sacramento Area Council of Governments, that led an effort in our region called Blueprint. And there was a slide that was put up here during the previous presentation that talked about how we were now going to coordinate our land use and our transportation planning. And as a region, we came together over the course of the last, really, 2004, 2005, and decided as a region we needed to grow differently. And our public sector and our private sector came together to figure that out. And we now have a plan moving forward. We got a lot more work to do, but we're moving in the right direction.
Thanks, Matt. Poncela, down to you. The Moses Agenda, of course, very extensive, but in terms of transportation,
You want buses, light rail, commuter rail. Can you help us understand what those services would do if you were lucky enough to get absolutely everything on the agenda? What would that do for people in the Detroit area?
Okay. Well, I'm going to start with just a personalizing a story. There is a woman named Renee Satchel, who was the chair of our transportation task force. And the way MOSES organizes, we look at building deep relationships and conversations, particularly around crossing geographical boundaries, city and suburb, race boundaries, Arab American, African American, Hispanic, and white in our communities, really breaking down even our own barriers that we represent the region as an organization, building relationships with these people who live in these various communities. They're very different from each other. So we start with the conversations. And we look at issues and how people feel and what their story is related to those particular issues. And we heard a story, and we heard many stories, but Renee Satchel's story was really important to us, and this is why she became the chair of the Transportation Task Force. She lived in west side of Detroit, worked in Troy at a temp agency, which is very far. If you know Detroit, the metro area, so it could be difficult to get to. But she would have to catch a cab to get to a point to catch two buses to get to where the good job was for her. She's a wife. She has two children. And so her commute was like 2.5 hours each way. So any good day, I mean, it's 4 to 5 hour commute, and we're talking going to Troy, not Chicago, right? Because people begin to look at their own personal connection to the issues and using their story and their anger about what's not happening in our region to actually move and push decision makers about the need to really for them to coordinate. If we can talk to each other about what's needed for our quality of life, certainly our public officials can do the same thing. So getting people connected to where the jobs once were downtown, some of the big corporations were downtown, moved out to Troy and to Farmington Hills, Bloomfield Hills. So we used to live near some of those businesses, and then when they moved, we had to figure out transportation to get to them where they were to keep those jobs. So, I mean, having that kind of a coordinated region would help the stress level of a number of people just in their ability to connect to get to where the opportunities are.
Thanks, Pocella. Alan, your research is helping those of us who cover transportation get a better understanding of the movement of lower-income folks to the suburbs. Please talk about why this is happening, why specifically lower-income people nationwide would be moving to areas that are so poorly served by transit.
Sure. I just for a moment, like to pick up on Poncella's story. I mean, one of the things that we've heard probably more often than anything else in rolling out this report and talking to audiences about it is, oh, you looked at job access. God, you gave people 90 minutes to get you a job via transit? That's crazy. Nobody would ever spend 90 minutes on a bus or on a subway. And our answer has been, well, we think there are people who don't really have many choices. And so the notion that somebody would spend 150 minutes getting to their job via transit makes me feel a little bit better about the choice that we made in our research. But I think it's emblematic of a labor market, and Detroit is in many ways the poster child for this, right? I think maybe 8% of the jobs in the region are still within 3 miles of the downtown. Mm-hmm. Upwards of 70% are more than 10 miles from the downtown. So I think the first thing that's going on is, well, low-income people are following the jobs. We have a social safety net now that's more reliant on work than ever, so people are following the imperative to work. Regardless of their skill level, regardless of their income level. People are moving, low-income people are moving to suburbs because the suburbs are getting older, their housing is aging, there's more affordable housing, not necessarily in the communities that have the jobs, but people are following, you know, opportunities. Maybe these are safer communities, maybe the communities have slightly better schools than they would have if they were still in the central city. And frankly, we have policies in metropolitan America today that are intended to deconcentrate poverty out of the ghettos and the barrios of inner cities of the past, give people, at least in theory, access to more opportunities in more parts of the metropolitan area. So on balance, I think all these are a good thing. I think the drawback, as you know, Bob, is it's leaving more of these low-income households out of the reach of the services that have traditionally served them in city neighborhoods. Transit is one of them. Social services are another. Child care is another. When you look in our report at low-income communities in suburbs, see these places are still pretty well served. We found that in suburban low-income communities, 75% of working-age residents had access to some form of transit. But again, as I said, these are often the communities that, don't actually have very many jobs. So you really need the transit to get across the metropolitan area in many cases to where the job centers are. So we have to think about this beyond the kind of hub-and-spoke systems of the past. The last thing you want to do if you've got a suburban low-income population is make them go all the way into downtown Detroit to get to the transit hub and then back out again to their suburban job center. I think, you know, San Antonio provides a good model of, you know, good thinking around suburb-to-suburb commuting. But we also need to think about, as I was saying earlier, about the other policies that can put the things that low-income families need in the places that are within better reach of transit, affordable housing principle among them.
Thanks, Alan. I'd like to ask our regional panelists some things about some specific projects in their regions and relate them to the issue of putting transit where the jobs are. Keith, can you explain to us the Fredericksburg Road project and how that might help on these lines?
Absolutely. Well, actually the biggest project in the history of VIA Metropolitan Transit. And by the way, VIA doesn't stand for anything. VIA is just a Spanish word for go. We're building our first bus rapid transit line, and it will connect our downtown with one of our largest employers, our medical center, along a corridor called the Fred Road Corridor, and then on out to another one of our largest employers and activity centers, the University of Texas at San Antonio. And we want to do this, again, to give an even better service to our current customers, but while trying to attract a whole new group of folks who would never have looked at public transit in the past, by giving them a one-seat ride from UTSA all the way to the downtown area for a very affordable cost. And our goal is to not only provide just transportation, but to actually be a catalyst in a couple of areas to start reviving the economy around a couple of major points. We're creating a transit center in the downtown area called our Westside Multimodal Center, and our goal is to work in partnership with the Housing Authority, the Chamber of Commerce, a whole host of other groups, including the local health services, to create a real place where a whole host of different things can happen right around this center, and use transit as the catalyst or as a glue to bring all these different entities together. So it's a really exciting project for us. If things go smoothly, we'll be opening it December of next year. So come out to San Antonio and take a ride with us.
Keith, an experience we're having here in Washington regarding establishing dedicated lanes and bus rapid transit is simply that we've got a lot of jurisdictions to deal with that, let's say even within a jurisdiction, the people who run the buses aren't the same people who control the roads. And that seems like a perpetual problem. Has that been an issue for you in your various locations?
It a mix. I used to live in the Portland area and actually ran the transit system in Vancouver, Washington, which provided a lot of access to a TriMet across the river, where we had a great relationship, long-standing contractual relationship, where definitions were drawn out about who was responsible for what and so forth. So it worked very well. Then there are other areas, the St. Louis area, for example, that has some really complex relationships that go on. And then others around the country where a person can get on one bus, then transfer to another one, and they've now transferred with a different fare policy. If they lose something, they don't know exactly who to call. If they have a complaint or suggestion, they may have to make multiple efforts to make it all work. We are very fortunate at VIA that we're the only one in San Antonio. There's no other transit authority anywhere close to us. So if there's any complaint, they only make one call and yell at me. But the other parts that really work with that is that we don't have the redundancies of 7, 8, 9, 10 different human resource groups of multiple IT groups, mm-hmm. of multiple groups who are all doing really the same thing in the same area. Mm-hmm. And I imagine that, at least theoretically, your costs have to go up if you're trying to deal with all those things on a micro level. And in our case, I think one of the reasons why we're so cheap, and VIA actually has one of the lowest per passenger subsidies in the entire country, is because of that very reason, is that we can concentrate our efforts on just providing great service and not having to deal with all the turf wars and those types of things.
Hmm. Thanks, Keith. Matt, concerning the Sacramento area, wasn't any one particular project that I wanted to ask you about. You've been in Washington the last few days on the annual Capital to Capital mission on behalf of the Sacramento area, and the chamber business leaders have a fairly broad agenda on transportation, a lot of road projects, interchange improvements, and so on, as well as transit. Can you talk about how you pitch transit projects to get the maximum result from federal officials or anybody with the money to do the things that you want?
Yeah, well, as everybody knows, it's an interesting time in Washington, D.C. right now. So just very briefly, every year the Sacramento Metro Chamber leads a delegation from the Sacramento region of Washington, D.C. It's our 41st year. This year we had 270 delegates join our trip. It's one of the largest Chamber of Commerce lobbying trips of its kind in the nation. We break off into 13 teams. We have about 60 policy positions, and over the course of 3 days, we do about 250 appointments. It's a pretty robust program. It's very labor-intensive, but it is really one of our region's competitive advantages as we look to compete, not just on a legislative process, but actually, you know, looking for federal appropriations for flood protection, which is a major issue in the Sacramento region, or for transportation projects. But really, our approach this last year, we did not come back with, you know, hat in hand looking for federal appropriations. We did. We were pretty mindful of the environment in Washington, D.C., and we came back with what we called funding opportunities and talked very specific about, as a region, we have, you know, these projects that are our highest priority. And the Sacramento region is made up of 22 cities and 6 counties, and we're able to get our elected officials to actually imagine this. An elected official in one city will lobby for a project in another city, knowing that at some point it's going to be their turn and the roles will be reversed. Right. So we actually have some phenomenal regional collaboration, and that is actually has become part of the norm in the Sacramento region because of, you know, 41 years of doing this annual cap-to-cap program, but also on the heels of Blueprint, which was this regional land use and planning process. Then we came through that. That was adopted unanimously by the Sacramento Area Council of Governments. On the heels of that, we put together our Metropolitan Transportation Plan for 2035. We came out of that. We did kind of a regional economic development strategy that kind of focused on people, on business, on place. And that brought together 34 nonprofit organizations in the Sacramento region. On the heels of that, our COG then started a rural-urban connection strategy to figure out, you know, we're a great agricultural region. How do we get all those products that are created, you know, developed and grown in the rural communities to market and to overseas? We don't have the infrastructure to support it. So we've been, and now we're working with HUD in the Sustainable Communities Initiative, and we're going to get, you know, we're really focusing on complete communities in the Sacramento region. It's taken us a while to really get there, and now we're looking to do real economic development strategies, cluster-based, a more robust program than we had originally, because we have 13% unemployment in the Sacramento region. We are hurting. We were one of the first regions into the recession, and we'll be probably one of the last in the country to come out. And I will say that we work really hard in the Sacramento region. We're not very smart, I guess. We got to work harder than everybody else. But it's really ingrained in good data and facts, spend a lot of time putting together those data and facts, and then a lot of good regional collaboration. And I'll just close with an example. We're so good at regional collaboration that last year we hosted, through the Northern California World Trade Center and our Council of Governments, 40 Afghani governors came to the Sacramento region to figure out how we collaborate and how we partner.
Wow.
Afghani governors coming to Sacramento to figure out, if they figure we can do it, maybe they can do it. I don't know. But collaborate and partner, come to Sacramento, and maybe we can teach you how to do it, and maybe we can learn some things from you as well.
Thanks, Matt. Let me go down to Poncello. One of the projects in your region that has been getting a lot of attention is the Woodward Light Rail line. Can you tell us basically what that is, and also why it's so difficult to get a project like this done and operating?
Okay. The Woodward Light Rail started out as the M1 rail, which was a 3-mile stretch from downtown Detroit to Midtown. And I think the effort was to raise private dollars to fund it. There was a glitch in that, and it ultimately is now going to the 8-mile border, which is still not enough. But the idea is to get a regional transit authority is what we would like to have, so that we could have projects like the Woodward Light Rail and bus service all be coordinated and actually leverage the necessary funding to get the projects moving. And I think the Woodward Light Rail has struggled with actually getting matching dollars, so that's when it eventually involved in getting the private dollars to match for federal dollars to stretch it all the way out to 8 Mile. The other piece is there isn't much conversation with some of our decision makers. So City of Detroit had their project and study to look at bus service and rail systems within Detroit, and then you have another effort going on. So we ultimately got the two to merge and work together. So I think there's so much apathy with the number of the residents who live there. We want to see it. We hear it being discussed. And I think we're moving in the right direction. I think soon there will be breaking ground on the Woodward Light Rail. Then we had an EIS study that's going on, and there were a lot of public hearings, and people gave their input, and it's been raised into the community that this is coming down the pike. But we still need to get the cooperation between the city and the suburbs to actually get real rail to go out to where the jobs are. Going to 8 Mile is not enough. So getting the Oakland County exec and this mayor of the city of Detroit and others to actually look at this rail system being the very beginning of something that could happen going out to the suburbs, like all the way to Pontiac. You asked about what's the difficulty, and I think, the lack of conversation or real conversation about what it's going to take to actually move something like this for the beneficial of the people. And I think there's a lot of, I don't know how far I should go with this, but there's a lot of political, debates that goes on about who controls it. If we had a regional transit authority, that would be resolved. And so we're pushing for a regional transit authority to coordinate all of our transit, the buses, the light rail, rapid bus systems. So there is a plan on the table right now that the 3 county executives and the mayor have agreed, and it's a beautiful plan. But now they come fall short of actually looking at a funding strategy for the plan. So we want them to go a little further and get creative and take the risk and put together a funding strategy so we could actually leverage a system that's coordinated and not piecemeal together.
So, Poncello, it sounds like it's not just about the money. It's about the political will to carry this out. Can you elaborate a little bit on why that political will is lacking?
We're on TV.
And the web.
On the web.
And I'm sure it's being recorded and captured.
I'm sure. Yeah. Well,
you can whisper it in my ear and then I'll
say. Okay. Well, I think there, there's so much history in Detroit, because of these, the rule, what they call the rule, the communities can actually have home rule, so they're independent, and so we have these bus systems that have, or cities that can actually opt out, like for an Oakland County and Wayne County, there are communities that can actually opt out of a bus system. So we have jobs that are on 275 in Livonia, and they actually can opt out. because they might not, for a reason, might not want certain people coming through their communities. Or so when it happened, we fought the first time for them to not opt out of the bus service, but then we weren't successful the second time. People lost jobs. This is an ongoing thing that is really hurting our region because public officials are not cooperating with each other and stop competing for the resources and really figure out how we can all win together. So there's egos at play, I believe. There's who gets what kind of funding. I know we push SIMCOG, which is our MPO, around making sure there's a fair voting structure, that there is a citizens advisory committee to actually weigh in on transportation issues. So we try as an organization to actually organize enough power to leverage and push our public officials and build support in those particular areas where they would have coverage if they decided to take a risk to move a particular issue. But if we can get our public officials to really see the benefit of really transforming our region in such a way, it's beneficial. But they need to look down the road and take some risks now and put the egos aside and look at we're all hurting in this together. It's not the city against the suburbs. It's all of us that are hurting. And we want them to really, you know, communicate and really make that happen.
The political difficulties, the pushback that Poncela is describing in the Detroit area, that seem typical of the nationwide experience?
I'd be hard-pressed to say that Detroit is a typical place. I mean, there are unique characteristics. Now I'm trying to be diplomatic. I mean, there are unique characteristics to Detroit that perhaps make these issues, and transit in particular, more of a flashpoint than it is in other major American metropolitan areas. And, of course, the extent of job sprawl, the extent of decentralization, the hollowing out of the core. I mean, one thing that transit depends on more than anything else to work is concentrations of population and jobs. That's how you get efficiency out of the system. That's how you make it work. That's how you make a competitive choice for households. That's how you make it work from a financial perspective. So there are lots of challenges there. But the politics, the fragmentation, I mean, you know, as Matt was saying, you know, before Sacramento had its come to Jesus moment, you know, you had 22 different cities. I mean, there are still about, I think, 15 or 16 different transit systems in the Sacramento region and a part of the country in the West where things do tend to be much more joined up and unified. So nobody is alone, I think, in this story from a political perspective. But just to join up, I think a little bit what Keith was talking about before and how we think about transit rather than a matrix, think about it as a public investment, and what Poncela was talking about, like, you know, well, we've got a very high unemployment rate. It's region-wide. I think the study, in a way, is not meant to replace thinking about public transit as an investment and all the benefits you get, how you get better looking when you take it, but it's meant to say, look, in addition to all that, this is a critical part of your labor market. Mm-hmm. And your labor market is not going to succeed in the long run if all you do is move people to the downtown and then back out to the suburbs or just within their own little jurisdiction. You need a region-wide, you have a region-wide labor market. You have to have a region-wide transportation system. And transit is a critical part of that. It's that access point. Yes, more jobs, better jobs. But if people are going to get to those jobs, transit's got to be a part of that solution. It has to be region-wide.
Mm-hmm. Keith, now, as we've all been talking about the economic and social goals of transit, I'm wondering if that sounds to you maybe different in the real world. You have a budget. You got to balance a budget. You got to make sure there's enough money coming in from the fare boxes to at least cover up big percentage of that. How much can we actually expect of any transit agency in solving our economic and social issues?
Well, I think transit agencies need to be smart, and there's some things that we definitely need to do more of, including taking a strong look at ourselves, as has been alluded to throughout the report and many other times, that many of the transit routes were done generations ago. And many have not been updated, except on the periphery. And I think all agencies need to take a fresh look at their routing structure, how they charge fares, that it doesn't necessarily have to be one size fits all, and begin to bring more sophisticated business practices to the way we do business. One of the reasons why I was hired in San Antonio is that we've had such a good history whether in Charlotte or Richmond or other places where I've had a chance to work, of dramatically reducing our cost. And we try to do that by looking at top to bottom elements of our business, and then being strategic about making some sometimes bold decisions that can work out well for you. Last August, was faced with making a decision about fuel cost, and my CFO came in and we had a chat about should we hedge our fuel. And at the time, fuel was about $2.25 a gallon. For a quarter more, I could go ahead and lock in a rate for the next year and a half. So we did. And we're paying today and through the end of the year 2012, $2.47 per gallon. It saves us just under $500,000 a month by doing this. And so I think transit agencies have to look at those sorts of things as we make good decisions. Now, just as easily, the unrest that's happened in the Middle East and other things that have led to the prices going up could not have happened, and I'd be here looking for a job because I made a bad choice about that. But I think as business people, we also just need to make sure our transit agencies reflect good practices and sound accounting principles and so forth as we run our agencies.
Matt, I wonder if you could talk a little bit about the pushback on your agenda. You've told us about the sales pitch for some transportation projects. What's the main counterargument that you hear when you come to a place like the nation's capital?
Just, it's simply put, it's a lack of resources. I mean, we have a federal deficit that just, depending on who you talk to, whether the House or the Senate or the administration, they all have a different position on the federal budget deficit. So when you're looking for hard costs to build out your infrastructure, nobody's going to write you a check. We were in Senator Dianne Feinstein, who is a great senator from the state of California, yesterday, and she's in the Appropriations Committee, and we read the Riot Act. Don't come back here looking for funds, and that's about the third year in a row I think I've heard that message. So it's very clear to me we don't go into our office looking for funds. You don't have to tell me something twice. So especially if you know Dianne Feinstein, she's a wonderful leader for our country and very strong, demonstrative in her opinions. This is being recorded, isn't it? Yeah. We have the same problem at the state level. We have a $26 billion budget deficit in the state of California that there is no solution in sight whether to raise. There is no appetite, apparently, from one side of the aisle to raise taxes and not enough appetite on the other side to do $26 billion worth of cuts. The same is happening at our county. The main county in Sacramento County has a $60 million budget deficit. It's the third year in a row they've had major deficits. The city's got a $40-plus million structural deficit. There's no funds. We've built out an infrastructure. We can't operate the system the same way. And we are reducing routes. And once you put a route in and you try to reduce it, you know, you're impacting people's ability to get to their jobs. Mm-hmm. So we, as a chamber of commerce, mm-hmm. we push heavily on those transportation agencies to think differently, really try to really work more effectively, work more efficiently, focus on data, put your routes where you have the strongest ridership we need to work on fare box capture to get those rates up so we're not subsidizing it as much. And it is a challenge. Because we do have a lot of different agencies, it's not, you know, we're not completely in sync in the Sacramento region. We have a lot of work to do, and we need additional resources to do that work. So it's a challenging environment, but we're not alone. I think we're all in it together. So I think we all have to think how we're going to solve these issues in a new way, using innovative thinking, more collaborative processes, private-public partnerships. And I think the business community really needs to understand that they're part of the solution. Often they don't. They often think, oh, that's government's problem. Well, I think the business community really needs to step up and become a partner with government and work with them hand in glove for economic development and how we create jobs, where we put those jobs, and just solve the issue. But we're going to have to be innovative.
Thanks, Matt. Alan, a money question for you. I'm thinking about some of our transit projects here in the Washington region. Every idea we have seems to start at $1 billion and go up from there. Why is it worthwhile for us as a nation to make these enormous investments in transit? And if we want to help low-income folks, for example, why shouldn't we just make it easier for them to carpool?
You know, I think, as with a lot of things in public policy, it's not an either-or situation. I do think we need a mix of approaches, and we can't be orthodox that, you know, our goal is to get 100% of people, low-income people, onto public transit, and everybody should live above a streetcar or that sort of thing. The reality in America today is that two-thirds of lower-income people get to work the way most Americans do. They drive a car alone. That's part preference. I mean, they get the flexibility, the freedom associated with having a car, and perhaps access to an expanded set of job opportunities relative to what they get via transit. But part, it's a lack of options, too, a lack of viable options. It might not be transit near their home, might not be transit near their work. I think that's what our study is showing. Or maybe they work at hours that don't really coincide with when transit's available, too. So I think it is a question of, you know, what's the role of public policy in achieving that balanced mix between the billion-dollar investments and what might, at the outset, look like lower-cost, more flexible options. We've got a lot of goals to meet here. We have to, you know, we have to maximize labor market opportunities for people. We have to minimize costs for the public as well as minimize costs for private households themselves. And then we've got to minimize the externalities associated with transportation, congestion, the environmental impacts, too. I just say on that specific private cost issue, when you think about cars, like, should we just be giving everybody a car? It's not obvious, especially for low-income people, that, you know, putting them in a car, you know, behind the wheel, you know, private car ownership, the cost of that can be very significant from the standpoint of a low-income household. I think Keith had a figure. I was just looking at the research last week that, you know, a 2004 California study found that the typical low-income household drives to work spends about $3,600 a year annually on vehicle-related expenses. That is 19% of their budget. Those who are able to take public transit, it is $360 a year. It's a tenth of the cost, so about 2% of their budget. Again, it's still 66% of low-income households in cars. We need a mix of approaches, and that can be car-sharing programs. It can be public-private partnerships to expand transit. These should all be part of the response set. And, yeah, like in the farther-flung parts of metropolitan areas, the rural exurban fringe, car ownership programs may indeed make sense. But, you know, driving alone is going to continue to be the major way that low-income people get to work. But I don't think that public or private interest is necessarily served well by pushing that figure considerably higher, given, especially given the rise in energy prices we're seeing today.
All right, my brain is full. Now I'd like to ask for audience questions as the roving mic comes around. And again, please state your name and affiliation as we go around. Sir?
Thank you very much to the whole panel for your wisdom and comments. My name's Sam Black. I'm from Washington, D.C., and I have a question for Keith Parker. Keith, you mentioned that you perceived the West as being more pro-community and pro-transit in that respect, and that your experience in the South had been that it was there was more of an attitude of each citizen for himself, and that was was less supportive of transit. I wonder if you, could, from the Washington point of view, some of us have seen that contrast as being libertarian politics as being opposed to transit, and other politics as being more supportive of transit. I wonder if you could comment a little bit more on this point, and also if you could comment on what's the local political support in San Antonio for VIA, and if rail is a good option for your future. in San Antonio. What's the local political, what would be the local political support for rail transit?
Wow, that was a lot. Again, just being a student of politics, watching the way different regions tend to interact, and this isn't necessarily a criticism of the South or showing preference towards the West or other areas around the country. It just is what it is, and I don't think very many Southerners would say we want more government in our daily lives and so forth. But some of the realities of how that manifests is in that you'll find the lower income folks in Southern areas have a tougher time of getting out of their situation because of some of the institutional and geographical boundaries that are just present for them, versus in some of these other areas where mobility, particularly, is more readily available, then I think people can improve their situations. Now, our local situation in San Antonio is very good. We have a mayor who's pretty dynamic in terms of wanting to see the city go to that whole next level, including major emphasis on education and on transportation, a real recommitment to developing the downtown area, and of course the transit system will be right there lockstep with them. The Chamber of Commerce has shown some real leadership in terms of wanting to see major transportation improvements, both road and public transit. And then many stakeholders, whether they're neighborhood leaders, other political leaders, and then a very progressive board of directors that I happen to work for in San Antonio, make for a pretty nice mix right now. So we think our future looks pretty bright. The biggest challenge is that this long-range plan that we are hoping to have adopted next month has a multi-billion dollar price tag to it, and they all do. So the argument is, are the priorities that we are going to lay out in that plan going to be palatable to the citizens, and are they willing to pay for it? We are currently a very, very low-cost system. Our cost per passenger is about half that of what it is in Dallas or Salt Lake City and some of the other really nice transit systems. But with that low cost comes lower quality of service in some respects as well. So we'll be making the pitch to our citizens that making a bigger investment in VIA is going to be an investment that pays off.
Over here.
My name is Alice Ortuzar, and I live in Montgomery County. I lived in Sacramento in the 1980s, and it was the first time that I ever saw a turn lane for bicycles in the intersection. Mm-hmm. And I hope that this ability to commute on a bicycle safely has continued with your changes. My concern is there seems to be a lack of emphasis on changing paradigms. We talk about fare box recovery, but roads never seem to have that same recovery as part of it. And the Center for Defense Information once estimated the true cost of a gallon of gas to be $91 when you include the military expenditure. So I think I'm looking to an institution such as Brookings to change the paradigm. Lester Brown, the author of Plan B, says we need to redefine national security. And I wonder if there were federal funding for transit the way there has been for roads, if the political tensions in Detroit would be quite so difficult to overcome. And for instance, in Montgomery County and in the D.C. area, we're shortchanging, it appears, some of what we're building. There's still an addiction to roads, an addiction to developers. So instead of extending the metro to Shady Grove, to Frederick, they want the BRT, and then they're going to expand the interstate. And I'm wondering to what degree Brookings is going to look at maybe changing this. And just one last note, the National Association of State Legislatures also has research. For every job that is created with military spending, that same amount of money invested in the public-private sector would create 9 jobs. So I think we need to look at how to reallocate our resources and redefine our priorities.
Seems like a bunch of issues in there. Alan, I wonder if there's anything about the
I thought it was a bike lane question for Matt, but are they still there?
We have the bike lanes are still there in Sacramento. In fact, we continue to add bike lanes. We've taken a balanced approach to our transit planning in the Sacramento region for bike, pedestrian, roads, and transit. In fact, in 2004, we passed a half-cent sales tax throughout Sacramento County to implement a balanced transportation solution. So to answer that question, we're good.
Matt, and to build on that, this project is part of a much larger, longer running series of research and policy analysis of Brookings led by my colleague Rob Puentes, which is really in pursuit of a balanced, data driven, strategic national transportation policy. And so there are lots of issues that go into that. Military spending, I'm not sure exactly where or if it factors in, but is really intended to, help public policy grapple with what the true full costs are of different transportation choices, more than just, the fare box stuff or the gas tax. This stuff is not, and it's not just about transportation. It's about the types of communities we're going to build and whether they're really going to be supportive of a new model of economic growth that's better than the model that just came crashing down on us.
Matt, do you find it's any easier to sell a roads project than a transit project? Any sort of categorical breakdown like that?
We all have politics. Sacramento region is no different than any other. The core of Sacramento is much more politically liberal than the suburban outlying areas, although some of the demographics are changing. What we found when we've been able to address our transportation needs, again, it goes back to that mantra of trying to put together a collaborative process where you include the public sector, you include the business community, environmentalists, the labor communities, and the neighborhood communities. And we've developed a good practice in the Sacramento region of doing that. Sometimes as a business guy, it drives me nuts because it's a long, I just want to get it done. But in order to have a collaborative process and usually get the best outcome, that's actually going to stick. We found that, you have this process and you bring people along and you're able to get through that outreach and really getting the neighborhood outreach, you're able to get a lot of the elected officials who wouldn't come along and support transit to come along in that process. And some elected officials who wouldn't have come along to build roads or an overpass in a certain community, they'll come along because the neighborhoods and the businesses are clamoring for it. So it's a matter of getting those folks, everybody in the room, and bringing them to the middle and getting out of the soundbite politics that we're all used to seeing right now.
Let's see. Let me get to the mid-back here. Gentleman in the – you, sir, yes.
Hi, I'm John Swanson with the Metropolitan Washington Council of Governments. I'm wondering if you could talk about the last mile challenge. A lot of times people get to station and then getting to their job is a big hassle. And I'm talking about sidewalks and circulator systems. And how important is that? We kind of know what needs to be done, but I'm wondering, is that the easy part? Is it the hard part? What do you think?
Keith, maybe you could talk about that as an operator.
He's just commenting that that's a part of the weight loss strategy. That's a good one. Well, that is a major challenge because quite often that last mile is the least efficient when you look at your overall cost of providing that trip for that customer. And it's where, again, we have to talk about these things as overall public investments. That when I look at some of the most well-received routing that I've ever actually been a part of, in Charlotte, we came up with this whole network of what we call neighborhood circulators, and it was primarily used by people who didn't have cars to get to the grocery store. But when we looked at the fare box recovery, as this young lady pointed out, it was dismal. But for those customers who used it, it was absolutely lifeline levels of service for them. And so I think as we talk about these last miles and so forth of service, we have to look at them not in the same box in comparison with the line haul routes or the major rush hour routes and so forth, and look at them as add-ons or as just necessary complementary pieces of your overall system. But it's tough in this environment because everybody's struggling with budgets. Everybody's struggling with trying to put the most service where you're going to get the highest bang for the buck, and trying to balance all those things is just what led to my hair loss. So
let's get one more question. Here, sir, you in the second row.
Sandy Apgar, Baltimore. Substantial number of Americans now work from home or from employment centers very close to their homes. The number is growing, promoted both by corporate policies and federal policy now. How do your respective plans accommodate that trend, which in some respects is counter to the public transit need and system, yet enabled by it, as well as the technology that provides the infrastructure?
Matt, can you talk about the business community in Sacramento? Or are you folks pushing telecommuting?
Well, absolutely, and I know that our transportation planning, we look at the peak hours of transit commuting. Like I said, I'm not a transit policy wonk, but I know from personal experience, I try not to get in the roads certain periods of time, and there's also a time when you want to ride transit. But all of our planning in the Sacramento region has really become about data and gathering that data and tying it into economic development planning and gathering more information. We have, from a land use planning, we have information down to the parcel level throughout the greater Sacramento region. We're now starting to integrate, I believe through our Sustainable Communities Initiative, economic data as it relates to jobs, and trying to gather that data and how it impacts transit and mobility throughout the greater Sacramento region. We have some high-tech clusters. Intel's a major employer in the greater Sacramento region. Government dominates, you know, and the government really is, you got to be in your office 8 to 5. So telecommuting isn't an option for everybody, but I do know that major employers are pushing that. It's a quality of life question for a lot of folks. I certainly enjoy working from home periods of time, although it's difficult when all of a sudden I got a honey-do list and I got my 10-year-old bugging me. But, again, planning needs to go, and it all needs to be driven by data. And the more data you have, the better planning you're going to be able to and go implement.
Well, thanks, panel and audience. I want to urge everyone get some time and click around on the Brookings website and see the fantastic amount of interactive material they have for us. I got my first chance to look at the Washington area this morning, and I really want to get back to that. We're going to leave the stage now. The next session about the federal response, that's going to start almost immediately, and so it's a good idea to stay in here. We don't have a break for you before you are going to learn some more. Thanks very much.